That line's official figures show Eurozone inflation hit a new record in July as growth in Europe's largest economy, Germany, stagnated in the second quarter of this year. Russia expresses solidarity with China over its stance on Taiwan after Beijing warned Washington not to, quote, play with fire over the island. A teenage Palestinian boy is killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, the news on Eurozone economy has been bad for months. Now official data show inflation across the Eurozone has reached another record high. The EU statistics agency, Eurostat, says that Eurozone inflation has climbed to 8.9% in July. That's why the fight against rising prices has raised fears of a recession. Meanwhile, Europe's largest economy, Germany, has experienced a period of stagnation this year. Official statistics say the German economy showed 0% growth in the second quarter of 2022. The global supply chain problems and the fallout of the Ukraine war are among the main contributors to the economic hardships across the Eurozone. Meanwhile, the entire EU has run into difficulties with its energy demands amid the face-off with Russia. That has resulted in a hike in gas prices. Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels. Jerome, what more can you tell us about this data and why do the inflation numbers keep getting higher and higher in Europe and specifically in the Eurozone?
Well, of course, inflation is growing. And by the way, you're talking about the 19-nation Eurozone. In January, it'll be 20 countries when Croatia joins Bardia. But the point is that it's just below 9% now on average. But if you look at individual countries, even within the Eurozone, not talking about the other countries in the EU, well, actually, it's higher than 9%. And actually, if you speak to economists, they say that actually the real number, it's very difficult to measure inflation in real terms. So actually, the real inflation figure could be much higher. But actually, if you go on the internet, not without mentioning individual companies, but if you go on the internet, you will see that the energy companies in the West, in the United States, and also in the EU, their profits have increased not by millions, but billions since February the 24th, since the escalation in Ukraine. So billions of euro more profits for energy companies. Also look at the arms industry. Look at what's being sent to Ukraine from the United States, from the UK, and from the EU. Billions of euro worth of weapons. And all the while, these companies and their shareholders are making huge profits. And those speculating on the markets, by the way, the markets are fluctuating up and down, and the currencies are fluctuating up and down. And those people who are speculating on the currencies and on the markets, they're making huge profits because they can see when the ECB is going to do something, or they can see when the Federal Reserve is going to do something. And all the while, it's the ordinary people who are paying through the roof on their mortgages now because interest rates are going up, paying through the roof because of energy prices going through the roof, food prices, etc. So it's a very dire situation as we speak.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Moving on, Belarus has recalled its ambassador to Britain in response to what it describes as hostile and unfriendly steps taken by London. The Belarusian Foreign Ministry said in a statement the UK's policy systematically caused damage to Belarusian citizens and legal entities. The statement was referring to sanctions on Belarusian companies, national airline, and restrictions on its state media. Belarus's Foreign Ministry said it's not severing ties with London, but downgrading its diplomatic mission to temporary chargé d'affaires. The ministry said it would consider restoration of dialogue with Britain once, quote, responsible politicians appear in the British government. Ties between Minsk and London have been tense for months now. Well, Moscow and Kiev blame each other for a deadly strike on a jail that housed Ukrainian prisoners of war in a town controlled by pro-Russians in Donetsk. Russia accuses Ukraine of hitting the facility with U.S.-made rockets.
A missile strike from a U.S.-made multiple-launch rocket system HIMARS was carried out on a pre-trial detention center in the area of Alenivka, where Ukrainian military prisoners of war, including fighters from the Azov regiment, are being held.
The Russian Defense Ministry called the attack a, quote, egregious provocation designed to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. The ministry said 40 prisoners were killed and dozens of others injured in the attack. Ukraine denied carrying out the strike and put the blame on Russia. It said Russian forces conducted the raid to accuse Kiev of committing war crimes. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Russia throws its weight behind China and the Taiwan issue, urging the United States to stick to the one China policy and not to aggravate the circumstances.
We have no problems with upholding the principle of China's sovereignty, and we proceed from the fact that no irritants, no provocations that can aggravate this situation will be undertaken. Our position regarding the One China policy remains unchanged. The United States periodically confirms the same position in words, but in practice, as you know, their deeds do not always correspond to their words.
The Kremlin has also expressed solidarity with China over Taiwan. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters Moscow respects China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He warned against any provocative steps regarding the issue. This after the Chinese president warned his American counterpart in a phone call against a potential visit to the island by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Those who play with fire will eventually get burned. I hope the U.S. side can fully understand that. The United States should abide by the One China principle with regard to Taiwan and ensure that its actions are consistent with its words.
Well, this is the latest in a series of warnings since reports emerged that Pelosi could pay a visit to Taipei in August. Last week, the Financial Times reported China had alarmed the U.S. Privately that the move could possibly provoke a military response. Beijing said such a visit would send a wrong signal to separatist forces in Taiwan. It has warned that the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences of Pelosi's planned trip. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taipei, which China considers as part of its territory. Taiwan says it will continue to develop its close security partnership with Washington. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Mr. Greg Simons, who's joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. And also we have political analyst Bijan Tavassori, who's joining us from Hamburg. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Greg Simons, and let's jump right in. I want to get your thoughts and your perspective as Russia's thrown its weight behind China on the Taiwan issue.
Well, it's pretty clear. I mean, they're taking a very similar strategy and using it against China versus Taiwan as they did between Russia and Ukraine before the war broke out. That this is meant to increase tensions and, I mean, this controlled chaos, which the US hopes to reassert itself as the leading global power, which at the moment is in disarray.
All right, Bijan Tavassori, I want to get your perspective as well. How much can this change, probably change the United States' stance with regards to Taiwan now that Russia is throwing its weight behind China when we're talking about this equation?
Yeah, I think it serves to underline the strength of the alliance between China and the Russian Federation in regards to territorial sovereignty between the two nations and in regards and in the face of the threat from the United States and NATO. So this really is not a surprise to the United States. They know that Russia would back China in this specific instance because it really goes to the heart of the Chinese nation's interest, really the most fundamental issue to any nation, which is the territory. And so if House Speaker Pelosi really insists on going to Taiwan, then she will most likely be met with military resistance of the People's Liberation Army and their navy, which have now become the biggest and largest navy in the entire world. So this could come down to a real showdown between the two superpowers on the seas, and it could really lead to something that military confrontation that could potentially spark World War III. So I think the onus is on the American side to step back from this confrontation.
Back to Greg Simons. As we mentioned, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi could potentially visit Taiwan in August. Beijing has warned the U.S. Would be held responsible for any serious consequences of Nancy Pelosi's planned trip. Would you draw any comparisons to what took place with regards to Ukraine and the stance that the United States has now with Taiwan as opposed to China?
Well, what it's doing, it's very similar to what the United States was using between Russia and Ukraine, which was to constrain and contain Russia. And they're using attempting a very similar strategy with China over Taiwan. However, this, of course, what we've seen, the response from Russia to the Ukrainian situation has actually undermined the US strategy. And they're repeating the same strategy again with China and Taiwan. The U.S., should we say, intellectually, is not what it used to be. It's fighting a very short term and ultimately engaging in a losing strategy.
Bijan Tavasuri, would you draw that same comparison as well? We have Russia and Ukraine on one side, and then maybe connect the dots and see Taiwan and China on the other hand when we're looking at the actions and the rhetoric of the United States.
Yeah, I think you can easily draw one very obvious parallel, and the striking thing is that Ukraine didn't come out of nothing. For the last 8 years, the Russian government on all levels has warned the United States to desist from what they did following the regime change in Kiev in 2014. And the United States has just added provocation upon provocation. In the end, it turned out to a military conflict that we are now witnessing. And in the case of Taiwan, I think the issue is even more serious to the Chinese government, to the Chinese people as a whole. And so they are not going to step down. And they have warned the United States privately on all levels, most recently yesterday with the over 2-hour-long phone call between the presidents, President Xi Jinping and President Biden, where, well, it's not a public phone call, but I'm sure that President Xi has reiterated the Chinese government's position and the really seriousness with which they claim the Taiwan as part of their nation. And so President Biden knows what's at stake here. And after all, it's his choice to make, because the Speaker of the House will be accompanied by the United States military if she goes there. And so if he decides to let the United States military basically do what is an intervention on the territory of the Chinese nation, then the People's Liberation Army has to respond, and it has already said that it will respond. And so then it will be on the United States side to see whether they can suffer defeat and or if they have to, well, claw World War III back from the brinks of defeat.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Political analyst Bijan Tavasuri joining us from Hamburg, and also researcher at Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Greg Simons, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Palestinians are having no respite from Israeli atrocities as the regime's forces kill another teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a 16-year-old died of critical wounds sustained by live bullets in the chest. Another Palestinian was also shot and wounded by Israeli forces. The Palestinians were holding a demonstration near Ramallah against Israeli settlements when they came under attack by the regime's forces and settlers. Israel has recently ramped up its violence against Palestinians, killing over 50 since late March. Nearly 700,000 Israeli settlers live in settlements in East Al-Quds and the West Bank. The settlements are built on land captured following the 1967 war and are illegal under international law. Well, this just in, at least 22 Palestinians have been injured in Nablus after Israeli troops opened fire on protesters using live bullets. We've talked to our correspondent in the West Bank, Mona Kandil, for more information about the killing of Palestinian teen by Israeli forces.
A 16-year-old Palestinian teenager, Amjad Abu Aliya, from the village of Al-Mghayr near Ramallah, was shot dead by Israeli forces, by the fire of Israeli forces and Israeli settlers. This is according to eyewitnesses there. There was an invitation or a call for Palestinians to take part in an anti-Israeli settlement protest, because Israeli settlers there, protected and backed by Israeli forces, continue to storm the Al-Mghayr village on a daily basis, attack Palestinians, throw stones at them, hit them in order to force them leave their lands, because the settlers want to confiscate more lands in the village of Al-Mghayr. So Palestinians were protesting there following the Friday prayers, and Israeli settlers raided again the village of Al-Mghayr, backed and supported by fully armed Israeli forces. And we have to mention that the Israeli settlers themselves are also armed like the Israeli soldiers. They opened fire at Palestinian protesters there, wounding dozens of them.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
In Britain, shop prices for the month of July soared by the greatest amount since at least 2005, as the cost of fresh food was driven up by rising charges for fertiliser, animal feed and transport. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sarah Butler. The piece is titled, Rising Production Costs Lead to 4.4% Rise in UK Shop Prices. In Britain, shop prices for the month of July soared by the greatest amount since at least 2005, as the cost of fresh food was driven up by rising charges for fertilisers, animal feed and transport. Prices rose by 4.4% compared to July of last year, a step up from a year-on-year rise of 3.1% in June, according to the British Retail Consortium's latest shop price index, collated with market research firm Nielsen IQ. Fresh food inflation soared to 8% according to the index from 6.2% a month before, the highest rate since March of 2009. That contributed to overall food inflation of 7%. Helen Dickinson, the chief executive of the British Retail Consortium, a trade body which represents most major retailers in Britain, said, some of the biggest price rises were seen in dairy products, including lard, cooking fats and butter. Helen Dickinson added, households and businesses must prepare for a difficult period as inflationary pressures hit home. Rising production costs, from the price of animal feed and fertilizer to availability of produce exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, coupled with exorbitant land transport costs, led food prices to rocket. The high rate of inflation on basic food essentials is likely to hit low-income households in Britain much harder, ramping up pressure on those already affected by the cut in universal credit benefits and rising energy and petrol costs. A fifth of British households now have an average shortfall of £60 a week between what they earn and what they need to cover essentials such as energy bills, rent, transport and food. As the rising cost of living leaves people with the lowest amount of spare cash in almost 5 years, according to data from the Asda Income Tracker, collated by the Centre for Business and Economic Research, CBER, out this week. Shoppers are switching to discount stores, dropping brands in favour of supermarkets' own label goods, and trimming back spending on luxuries such as subscription services as they try to make their budget stretch. Food is not the only contributor to shop price inflation. Non-food prices were pushed up by 3% on July of last year, according to the BRC figures, as a result of higher shipping and production costs, partly caused by continuing disruption in China from COVID-related restrictions. Helen Dickinson said, as inflation reaches new heights, retailers are doing all they can to absorb as much of these rising costs as possible and to look for efficiencies in their businesses and supply chain. With households enduring a cost of living crunch, retailers are expanding their value ranges to offer the widest variety of goods to those most in need, providing discounts to vulnerable groups and raising staff pay. Also in Britain, in the Conservative Party leadership race, Rishi Sunak has promised to scrap VAT on household fuel bills for a year to tackle the cost-of-living crisis in a dramatic U-turn as he battles to remain in the race to become the next Prime Minister. With his rival Liz Truss promising £30 billion in immediate tax cuts, Rishi Sunak has reportedly stressed the risk of unfunded promises and insisted he has already taken action to cushion the blow of the sharp increase in domestic energy bills expected in October. But as he continues to trail the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss in polls of Tory members, and with ballot papers landing within days, he announced a new handout worth £160 for every household, despite having previously condemned the policy. As Chancellor, I knocked £400 off everyone's energy bill and provided support of £1,200 for the most vulnerable households. This additional VAT cut will help deal with the current emergency, Rishi Sunak said, claiming it was a benefit of Brexit that he was able to take the measure. He added, this temporary and targeted tax cut will get people the support they need, while also, critically, bearing down on price pressures.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We begin this sermon the way the Commander of the Faithful would begin his sermons, by advising each of us, Usikum ibadallah bitaqwallah, that I advise you, O the servants of God, to be God-conscious, God-fearing, and pious human beings. We are, alhamdulillah, at the doorsteps of the month of Aza, the month of commemoration and buka over the istishhad of Aba Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi afdalu salatu wa salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The month of Muharram and Safar and the commemoration of this tragedy has tremendous benefits associated to it. To be the guests of the Azadari of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, we have certain etiquettes that we have to make sure that we fulfill, right? We are coming into gatherings that are blessed. We are coming into gatherings that are a continuation of the legacy that was started by our A'imma alayhimus salam. You know, Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam and the families in Medina were the first ones to organize majalis and mourning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein. And it continued with our fifth imam, who would do it at his own homes, and then with our sixth imams and our seventh imam. And it continues, and alhamdulillah, we are part of that legacy. But there is certain etiquette that is required. And so I want to very briefly talk about five things, and I hope that inshallah you will, and I will, do these five things, for it enhance our experiences and our understandings in this month. You know, the first thing that I want us to remember about attending these majalis is that there has to be sincerity in the attendance of these majalis, right? We have to attend them for the right reasons, right? It's not something we do simply to check off and say that we have done. But we have to come to these lectures and we have to come to these gatherings to gain knowledge. Yeah? This is a university that we are coming into, a university that is unparalleled, that the entire world for 12 nights will be gathering for lectures. And it's not just about the huzn and the buka, but it's to learn something, right? And the way we show our sincerity with learning something is to bring a notebook. Yeah, I know I'm asking for a lot. Yeah, you don't have to bring a notebook. Bust out your phones if you have to, right? But man, learn something, right? Learn something. We all do this. We all do this. Excellent lecture today. You say, wallah, I don't remember. Yeah? I don't remember. But it was an excellent lecture. We all have done that, right? But why? Imagine like empty, like we're like empty vessels sometimes. And I'm not scolding, but sometimes it is scolding, you know, that I have to do. I remember, and you've heard me give this analogy. My teacher mentioned this, and it's a beautiful analogy, that oftentimes we blame the speaker for not connecting with us. Yeah, that the masaib was weak, you know, the masaib wasn't good, the lecture didn't have content. You know, that's a cop-out, okay? That's a cop-out, because it's not up to the speaker alone, right? You look at Karbala, who was the speaker in Karbala? Aba Abdullah was the speaker in Karbala. The best of speakers, the most pious of people, the most religious of people, the most noble of people. He spoke to 30,000 people. History books say maybe 30 people came over, that's it. 30 out of 30,000 maybe came over. Do we blame Imam Hussein in Karbala then and say that it's Imam Hussein's fault? If he had spoken more passionately, people would have come? No. It's the hearts of the people who are listening. Yeah. If you come with sincere intentions, I swear you will leave as better human beings. But come with sincere intentions. Why are you here? So that you can uplift and keep alive the message of Aba Abdullah. So come with the intention of learning. Discuss what you have learned with your family when you get back into the cars. Remember that in these gatherings, you are the flag bearers of Azadari. You are continuing the legacy that had started 1350 years ago. And so there is a responsibility to attach to that. And also remember that when you come to these gatherings, the a'immah have gathered for these majalis. We believe that because we say, the Quran says that one who is martyred is alive. That means they are alive. Yeah, they come to these gatherings of remembrance. As hard as it is, this is not the time for joking during these 12 days. Yes, we smile at each other. Yeah, yes, we greet each other. Yes, we ask how are things, but this is not the time to make jokes and things like that. Especially the last few nights of Azadari are very solemn at these times, right? And I always say, you know, that it's been my custom, and alhamdulillah, it's been possible up to now. I don't know what will happen this year, but like on the day of Ashura, you know, they serve a meal after Ashura, and that's fine, that's fair. We have to eat, right? But I like to take my meal and go somewhere else because I know that if I stick around with people, we will end up laughing on that day. It's not the day to laugh, right? It's not the day. And so we have to have the right intentions, okay? We have to have the right sincerity when we come to these gatherings. That's number one. Number two, it is essential that we maintain akhlaq during these nights, okay? If we come to these nights, and if we have bad akhlaq with people, if we have bad morality with people, we have not understood the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Okay? Be kind to people. Be courteous to people. Be gentle with people. You know, we never know who's had a bad day. Yeah? Everyone has bad days. And they come to these gatherings having endured something that we have not endured on that day. We can control our emotions. We can't control other people's emotions. You know, who causes a fight? It's not the person who is rude who causes a fight. It's the person who responds to that rudeness who causes the fight. You can walk away. You can change. You can move. You can do whatever you want. But once you respond, you have caused a fight now. Yeah? Be in control of your own emotions. And at the same time, be cooperative with the volunteers and the management. We're in unprecedented times. No one likes to sit like this. As a speaker, I'm telling you, I don't enjoy this, right? There's no, as we call it, ronak. There is no nurani. There's no spirituality. Sometimes it feels like there is spirituality. There's no ronak. I don't know what the English word of ronak is, you know? If someone can tell me, you can tell me, you know? But we have to adhere to the policies that are in place. Right? And we have to make sure that we act with akhlaq, with our volunteers who are sacrificing their time and energy to be here. That's number two, maintain akhlaq. Number three, act with precaution. Please, act with precaution. Yeah. If you are sick, feel achy, don't come to mosque that day. Please don't come to mosque that day. Number four, volunteer your time. Yeah, I am sure they're looking for volunteers. Find out how you can help in volunteering.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
Limelight. Now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The fist bump was the least of it, says Phyllis Penny's author in an article published under the heading, "The fist bump was bad, but Biden's West Asia policies are worse." Stay tuned for the details, please. President Biden's fist bump with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the president's up-close and personal handshake with former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sparked outrage and cries of hypocrisy from human rights activists, supporters of Palestinian rights, and defenders of democracy. MBS is, after all, responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the war that has devastated Yemenis. Netanyahu, currently on trial for multiple corruption charges, presided for a dozen years over Israeli regime's apartheid system, settlement expansion, war crimes in Gaza, and the murders of several journalists even before Shirin Abu Akleh was killed in May. Outrage was absolutely called for. Symbolism is important, but the fist bump and the handshake were the least of it. Biden's first presidential trip to the West Asia region had a lot to do with consolidating U.S. power and countering Chinese and Russian influence there, strengthening the Israeli and Saudi-led coalition under U.S. leadership and increasing arms sales. The timing had a lot to do with the war in Ukraine and the price of oil at home, with global shortages and price hikes linked to the war-driven sanctions against Russian crude. Biden's trip had a message for all of that. MBS and the Zionist leadership have been eager to reaffirm their tight partnerships with the U.S., following their strategically consistent but symbolically extreme embrace by Trump. Biden's greetings made clear that consistency was indeed his agenda, and that apartheid, war crimes, and murder of journalists would pose no barriers to those special ties between Washington and its favored West Asia allies. But far more consequential were the actions, what Biden did and didn't do during his meetings. He did reaffirm the strategic ties with both Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, making clear that human rights concerns, even if mentioned, would have no impact on actual relations and, crucially, no impact on billions of dollars in military aid and arms sales. He did reiterate the pride of place that both the Israeli regime and Saudi Arabia hold in the U.S. government's West Asia policy, their bilateral ties with Washington, and their no longer secret ties with each other remain at the center of the U.S. strategy to continue as the dominant global power in the region. The president did say the right words, that human rights matter, that he believes Mohammed bin Salman is indeed responsible for the murder of Khashoggi, and that he still supports equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy for Palestinians and Israelis. But what didn't Biden do? He did not condition military sales to Saudi Arabia on ending the war against Yemen, despite the Arms Export Control Act's requirement that U.S.-provided arms be used for internal security or for legitimate self-defense. Like all his predecessors, he did not demand that U.S. military aid be conditioned on the Israeli regime, ending any of its specific human rights violations that keep equality but out of reach for Palestinians. He did not announce plans to cut that military assistance, even though the Leahy Law prohibits aid to any military unit that has committed a gross violation of human rights. And the U.S. admits the Israeli regime military was likely responsible for killing Shirin Abu Akleh. Despite his public assertions about human rights, Biden did not announce or make any moves to actually hold either of these key U.S. allies to account for their violations. When Biden chose Saudi Arabia for his first visit to the region as president, the regime was thrilled seeing the trip as a chance to reclaim its primacy as Washington's favorite Arab country. What MBS wanted was indeed primarily symbolic, a handshake, or in this case, the notorious fist bump, a globally televised reminder of his stature meeting the U.S. president was an equal. He wanted the return to normal optics for U.S.-Saudi ties after Biden's campaign pledged to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. The crown prince got all that, but he also wanted some other things way beyond the symbolic level. He wanted continued arms deals, U.S. backing for Saudi Arabia's military dominance as the top U.S. proxy in the Arab world, and a clear grant of impunity for human rights violations, whether war crimes against Yemeni civilians or the assassination of a U.S. resident journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And he got all that too. Biden claimed he pushed back, telling MBS directly that he believed the prince was responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Then he left it there and turned to business as usual. He could have gone on to say, "And because we hold you responsible for that murder, and because you are largely responsible for the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world today, the war in Yemen, we are not selling you any more arms until there is some kind of real accountability." In fact, Biden said nothing of the kind. His only apparent request not made publicly was for Riyadh to increase oil production levels to help replace Russian oil and lower global and U.S. fuel prices. What if, rather than urging more oil production, Biden had told MBS that the U.S. instead planned to help provide Europe with massive economic support for a fast transition to sustainable energy to replace its dependence on fossil fuels? And it turns out Saudi Arabia has just doubled its imports of cheap Russian oil at sanctions-reduced rates for domestic use, so it can sell its own crude on the global market at today's sky-high market prices. Overall, the joint declaration celebrates the unshakable U.S. commitment to Israeli regime security. It includes Washington's guarantee of the Zionist regime's qualitative military edge and pledges to preserve and strengthen Israeli regime's capability to deter its enemies and to defend itself against any threat or combination of threats, as they say. And the declaration even promises more military aid beyond the current level of $3.8 billion every year. While that commitment is not so unusual, the declaration then adds something not so commonly found in diplomatic documents, the claim that all those U.S. commitments are sacrosanct. That's a word rarely used to describe political positions. Merriam-Webster defines sacrosanct as holy or immune from criticism. Given the criticism from human rights defenders, Palestinian rights organizers, and anti-war activists that has followed Biden's trip to the region, the notion that continuing U.S. military aid and protection of Israeli regime apartheid will somehow remain immune from criticism seems like wishful thinking on the part of the White House. There were other points of clear agreement. Biden and his Israeli counterparts signed off on an attack on the Palestinian-led BDS, that is, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, promising to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israeli regime and to protect this regime at the United Nations and the International Criminal Court. And they agreed to allow all Israelis to enter the United States under the supposedly reciprocal visa waiver program, despite the Zionist regime's refusal to allow all U.S. citizens the same privilege. In fact, the U.S. State Department's own advisory warns that U.S. citizens of Arab or Muslim heritage, including Palestinian Americans, have experienced significant difficulties and unequal and occasionally hostile treatment at the occupied territories, borders, and checkpoints by Israelis. In 2017, Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia, where he signed an arms deal worth billions. In 2018, he announced a set of new U.S. policies towards the Zionist regime, moving the embassy to Al-Quds, recognizing Israel's annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights, and declaring the Jews-only settlements across the West Bank and East Al-Quds to be legal. Biden didn't ever agree with the Trump administration's position on the Israeli regime, and he called Saudi Arabia a pariah. He could have reversed Trump's policies on day one in the White House. But now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The first bump was the least of it.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. That other case was related to the Battle of Uhud itself. In the Battle of Uhud, the Muslims were victorious in the beginning of the battle. First, they attacked and crushed the enemy. But when they neglected the strait because of worldliness, the situation became reversed. God kept his promise to you, but what did you do next? Instead of being thankful for his blessing and divine promise and giving thanks for his divine grace, until when you became weak-hearted, when your eyes saw the spoils of war and that some people were collecting the spoils, you became weak-hearted and you disputed about the affair. You started to argue and disagree with each other. You see, you must look at these Quranic phrases from a scientific, sociological point of view. See how a country, a state, a government can progress, and on the other hand, how it can be stopped and how it can fall.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Find the answer to these situations in these Quranic verses. Until when you became weak-hearted and disputed about the affair and disobeyed, you had rebelled and disobeyed. The Prophet told you to do something, but you didn't do it. Then, when that happened, after he had shown you that which you loved, and after God had given you what you wanted, which was divine victory, and you were achieving complete victory, you behaved like that. So, of you were some who desired this world, and of you were some who desired the hereafter, and he turned you away from them. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 152. The Almighty God acted in accordance with his divine tradition and turned you away from them. He prevented you from defeating them, and instead you were defeated. This is another divine tradition. In the beginning, the divine tradition was that you stood up to the enemy's intimidations and moved forward. Then the divine tradition that applied to this situation was that due to your worldly desires, worldliness, seeking your own well-being, not working, not struggling, seeking the spoils of war and the like, you brought misery upon yourselves and others. Two verses that are close to each other in chapter Al-Imran talk about these two different traditions.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.